37 seconds left, 24-21. Buffalo on top. Now second and 10 at the 19-yard line of the Bills. 2x2 set. Newt takes the snap, immediately runs to his left. Turns outside the numbers and gets inside the 15. Ball's out. The ball's out. It's Buffalo football. Cam Newton fumbles the football with 31 seconds remaining in the game in the red zone.
With that game-sealing Cam Newton fumble in the fourth quarter, New England lost for the fourth straight time this season. And now at 2-5, the door may finally be closed on the Patriots dynasty. Today, Bill Barnwell explains what's happened to New England, how the Steelers are undefeated, who took over the NFC East, and who got punched in the helmet. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, November 2nd. This is ESPN Daily. Bill, anyone who has ever followed and arguably mostly unfollowed me on Instagram knows that I am a big sunset guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the sunset at 4:51 p.m. today, which honestly just feels criminal.
I mean, Pablo, as someone who works routinely until 6 or 7 a.m. in the morning on Sundays, nothing excites me like the idea of waking up at 11 or 12 later Monday morning, knowing I'm going to get 4, maybe even 5 hours of sunlight before the darkness approaches yet again.
Bill Barnwell is the host of The Bill Barnwell Show, and for him, time is an illusion. Well, I am also bringing you here because the sun is also setting, maybe a bit early, on the Patriots empire. And I say this because we've had the AFC East as the single most predictable division in sports throughout this millennium, but the Pats just lost their fourth straight game this season, Bill, to the division-leading Bills, 24-21. This wasn't a pretty win in Buffalo at all, and I know that their fans' heart rate is only now calming down, but how bad did the Pats look on Sunday?
This was a game out of 1970. There were windy conditions in Buffalo. The two teams combined to run the ball 72 times against just 46 pass attempts. And the Patriots never led for a single moment. Their offense kept dragging them back into the game, but their defense could not stop the Bills from running the football. Buffalo ran the ball 38 times in this game for 190 yards and 3 touchdowns. Just to put this in context, the Patriots allowed opposing offenses to run for at least 175 yards and 3 touchdowns 6 times across Bill Belichick's first 20 seasons in New England. They've now done it with the 49ers and the Bills in back-to-back weeks.
Wow. And it's worth noting this, too. I mean, last week against the 49ers, enormous questions about the Pats' offense had emerged because Cam Newton got benched after throwing 3 interceptions, and it seems like the good news on Sunday was that he did play all 4 quarters. He rushed for a touchdown. He did not throw an interception. But the bad news seems to be that it is November now, and Cam Newton has not thrown a touchdown since September. So how did Cam look to you in Buffalo?
Yeah, I mean, we saw several mistakes from him. He did miss a couple of those passes to the flat he's been struggling with. But this was a much better performance. I mean, Cam made several impressive throws over the middle of the field. The Patriots didn't have Julian Edelman. They didn't have N'Keal Harry. They had exclusively undrafted free agents at wide receiver. The Patriots got better play from their offensive line, and that really helped the running game. It helped Cam and Damian Harris combine for 156 rushing yards. But at the same time, whenever things got remotely sideways for this offense and they got behind schedule, they were drawing dead. The Patriots spent most of the first half stuck in third and long. They didn't have any margin for error, really, in this game. And when it looked like they were about to tie the game or even possibly pull out a victory on that final drive, that one fatal error from Cam Newton cost them their shot at the game.
Yeah, and I want to talk about what else this costs the Patriots, like in the big, big picture. And I'm honestly somewhat afraid as a professional gas bag here to even whisper this, given how stupid Belichick has made people like me sound in the past. But I know you're going to tackle this question in your column this week. So, Bill, is the Patriots dynasty finally over.
You whisper that as someone who sounds like he's been waiting 20 plus years for Dynasty and has been holding his breath for that entire time frame. This is being recorded, so I'm a little hesitant to give an answer that might be used against me in the future. I will say this much. It feels like it's on hiatus. The Patriots are 2-5 for the first time since 2000. That was Bill Belichick's first season as the Patriots head coach. Tom Brady was on the bench sitting behind Drew Bledsoe. Including the tiebreaker, the Patriots are now 4 games back of the Bills in the AFC East. Since the league went to its current structure in 2002, only 5 teams have made the playoffs after starting 2-5 as the Patriots have. And I wouldn't want to count the Patriots out altogether. They could still make a run. The Bills could take a step backwards. There's a 7-team playoff, so they have a shot of making it to the postseason. But there's nothing they can really sort of hang their hat on and say, this is what we do when the chips are down and we need a big play. There's always a chance. You never want to rule out the Patriots, but it does feel like they don't have that sort of next gear that maybe teams had in the past from under Bill Belichick. And hey, I mean, you could ask any Bills fan, or any NFL fan, really, because it seems to have happened to every NFL team that's played the Patriots at one point or another. That final possession on Sunday felt like the drive the Patriots always come up with to win the game. When they need to score, they somehow magically pull things together, get things right, and win the football game. The Patriots have owned that moment for 20 years now. It doesn't feel like they own it anymore.
And ownership of the AFC East, as crazy it is to continue this train of thought, it's up in the air as a result. And we're talking about the Bills now at 6-2. And on Sunday, we also saw the Miami Dolphins improve to 4-3 because they trounced the Rams 28-17. And look, the Bills and the Dolphins ahead of the Patriots, that's madness. But it seems like in Miami, something interesting is happening because rookie quarterback Tua Tagovailoa made his very first start and they got a very big win. So how much was Tua asked to do in his debut?
He wasn't asked to do very much. It was not the most impressive performance you'll ever see, but he did enough to win. He was 12 of 22 for just 93 yards, did throw his first career touchdown pass, and that's great.
Tua, shotgun, back to throw, looking, blitz, got touchdown! It. Parker!
Boy, Tua got rid of that ball quickly. Put it right where it needed to be. How about a little Tua touchdown? How about that?
Did lose an early fumble on a strip sack, and the Dolphins seemed to sort of want to take the game off his shoulders at that point. The receivers did not help out with drops. Aaron Donald had a great game against a middling Dolphins offensive line. But honestly, the guy who looked like the rookie making his first career start was the quarterback for the other team in this game. The Dolphins forced 4 takeaways out of Jared Goff, who threw 2 picks and lost 2 fumbles. Miami returned 1 for a touchdown.
Goff puts Henderson in motion. The throw gets hit. It's a fumble. The ball's on the ground. It's Van Ginkle going to the end zone. Nobody's going to catch him. The Dolphins take the lead.
Took another one to the 1-yard line and dropped another would-be pick 6. Jared Goff was a mess in this game. So Tagovailoa was able to shake some of the rust off. He got meaningful reps, but the Dolphins will need much more from him in the weeks to come.
So now I need to ask you about the team at the very, very top of the AFC, the team that survived a really tough game against the Ravens on Sunday. And we saw the Steelers hang on to beat Baltimore 28-24, which means that Pittsburgh is the one and only unbeaten team left in the NFL. So let's start here, Bill. How did the Steelers stop Lamar Jackson?
They didn't really. It was a really strange game, really. They had no answer otherwise for the Ravens running the football. Baltimore outgained Pittsburgh in this game by 236 yards.
Wow.
The difference, though, was 4 takeaways. One Jackson interception was returned for a pick 6 on the opening drive. The other one set up a short field and a second Steelers touchdown. Jackson's fumbles both came with the Ravens on the Pittsburgh 8-yard line. They cost the Ravens crucial points early in the game and then their best chance of taking the lead late in the fourth quarter. If anything, honestly, it's a testament to how good the Ravens are that they kind of came close to pulling this game out.
So they came very close, and that's impressive for the reasons you say, but they did lose, and so the Steelers now are 7-0, and I suppose that Pittsburgh has like the easiest, most obvious claim to the title of best team in football as we stand right now, halfway through the season, basically. So are they that?
Are they the best team in football? I think I would still take the Chiefs. And I think this game kind of reinforced that. I don't want to take anything away from this defense. They were the best junk defense in football a year ago. And they're the best junk defense in football this season. But the offense is still so inconsistent. You know, it's better than it was a year ago because last year they had Mason Rudolph and Duck Hodges at quarterback. And they were averaging fewer points per possession than any NBA team, let alone NFL teams. And they had a competent adult in Ben Roethlisberger at quarterback. And that is going to help them. It's going to raise their floor on offense significantly. But this offense is just too disjointed right now from possession to possession and week to week. I think I would still prefer the Chiefs, although admittedly, I saw them play the Jets, so anyone's going to look good after that.
All right, up next, we got to go from pondering the best of the best in football to pondering the best of the worst in football as I drag our competent adult Bill Barnwell back in here to talk about the NFC East.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Bill, we are back. We just finished watching Cowboys Eagles, and the clock says midnight. Our bodies, though, are screaming 1 a.m. Eastern. And it's hard to say how many other human beings like opted in to making it to the end with us on this game. But those who did were rewarded with the sight of Carson Wentz and the now 3-5-1 Eagles planting their flag atop the haunted landfill that is the NFC East. So how good exactly should Philly be feeling about Carson Wentz right now?
I have to admit, Pablo, it's hard to think of a critical division win by two scores in prime time. That was less impressive than what we saw from the Eagles on Sunday night. And you know what? The defense did its job. It was against an offense which had three or four backup linemen. It was quarterbacked by the equivalent of a young junk balling pitcher in Ben DiNucci, who, I mean, 10 years from now is going to be a meme about, oh, remember when this person quarterbacked the Cowboys on national television? But Carson Wentz was a disaster against one of the league's worst defenses. And yes, I mean, Wentz apologists, and we know they're out there.
Yes, they are.
They're going to blame the injury. They're going to blame Wentz's play on the injuries with the offensive line and the injuries at receiver. And yes, those things do matter. They don't force Wentz to make inexplicable decisions when he has the football in his hands. There's just no aptitude here for when to give up on a play or how to deal with the pressure by getting the ball out on time or quickly. Phillip Rivers is sort of the opposite here, where Phillip Rivers, when he sees a screen and he knows it's not going to work, even if it's a half second after he's gotten the ball, he just spikes the ball and says, okay, I'm going to move on and play another play. Phillip Rivers has also, by the way, not missed a regular season game due to injury in his entire pro career. Carson Wentz just seems to stare at the screen until it starts working, as if he's going to move the defenders with his mind before getting sacked and possibly injured. And yes, I mean, Wentz made a few impressive throws in this game. He has that in his arsenal, in his arm. But the difference between Wentz and DiNucci was not worth the difference in salary between these two guys, which is, I believe, a little over $30 million per year.
Man, geez. Well, speaking of, I guess, nonsensically humiliating on-field experiences, let's talk about what happened in the third quarter of this Saints overtime win over the Bears. Because in specific, I mean, there's lots of football to be discussed there, but I want to talk to you, Bill, about Bears wideout Javon Wims sneaking up behind Saints cornerback C.J. Gardner-Johnson after the whistle and then punching Gardner-Johnson in the head.
Wims and Gardner-Johnson exchanged blows, and Wims wound up and punched him flat out. And now there's a big pile up and a fight underway right in front of the Bears bench. Javon Wims retaliated. That's not going to end well.
Which was a problem, not least because Gardner-Johnson's head was very much inside his helmet. And so he just sort of stared at him blankly in response. So how would you describe what happened after that punch? And why did any of this even happen in the first place?
This goes back to last year. This is a long-standing feud which happened to
What?
Yes, it goes back to last year. So last year, C.J. Gardner-Johnson and a Saints teammate very visibly made fun of the height of Wims' teammate, Tariq Cohen, who's now missing with a torn ACL. Not something you want to do. Earlier in the Saints-Bears game, Gardner-Johnson appeared to poke Anthony Miller in the mouth between plays. He also, and this is also hard to tell from the footage we've seen so far, believe that he maybe ripped Javon Wims' mouthpiece out. I guess Javon Wims at some point gets it in his head that he is going to take a swing at C.J. Gardner-Johnson. Gardner-Johnson is seemingly minding his own business. Nothing seems to be happening. And then Wims walks up to Gardner-Johnson and either snatches his chain or goes to snatch his mouthpiece or attempts to do one of those two things with an indeterminate level of success. Then, as Gardner-Johnson recognizes that Wims is approaching him, he punches Gardner-Johnson in the side of the helmet. And Pablo, we are both current or former New Yorkers. C.J. Gardner-Johnson reacted to this in the same way that you would if you were holding a pole in the subway and someone bumped into you. You would say, why now? Why? What's happening here? Do you need my attention? Can I help you? Wims then punched Gardner-Johnson in the second time, which started a huge brawl. So I admire Javon Wims' persistence, but I don't think it worked out well for him or the Bears. He was ejected. Nick Foles threw an interception right after that brouhaha, and the Bears ended up losing the game in overtime.
Yeah, I just don't want to be involved in any part of that. That's my level of risk aversion, I would say. But if there is a team, an entire team, Bill, that might feel like it's been sucker punched this season, I mean, they've just suffered injury after injury after injury. And in their loss to Seattle on Sunday, we saw Jimmy Garoppolo and George Kittle both hobbling out of the game. And I want to ask about Jimmy G in particular, because he was playing terribly before being replaced by Nick Mullins. How much of that play do you think is due to that messed up ankle?
The Niners took Garoppolo out of the game with an ankle injury. He, of course, suffered a high ankle sprain earlier this season against the Jets and did miss a couple games before returning against the Dolphins. Here's what's happened since then. Garoppolo comes back against the Dolphins. He throws two interceptions on 17 pass attempts and gets benched at halftime. The following week, he plays the Rams. He's great. 23 of 33, 268 yards, three touchdowns. Last week against the Patriots, 20 of 25 for 277. Did throw two picks, but a pretty efficient game for Garoppolo outside of the interceptions. And then he's terrible this week and gets benched again for Nick Mullins. If it were the initial ankle injury, I don't understand why he would be really good for a week and then kind of good for a week and then really bad the way he was 3 weeks ago and get benched again. That's not the sort of linear, you know, return we expect from a typical ankle injury. Now, Garoppolo was playing a Seahawks team that, as good as the offense has been incredibly giving when it comes to allowing quarterbacks to hit plays downfield. Garoppolo was not making plays downfield against one of the worst pass defenses in all of football. And we saw when Nick Mullins came in, he was able to make plays. Granted, they were down multiple touchdowns, but he was able to make plays pretty comfortably against that pass defense. Now, Mullins did lock up a pass to Kittle, which ended with that star tight end making a spectacular catch, then limping off the field with a foot injury. There's no reports yet on how serious Kittle's injury is, but it's weird because the guys they bring in to replace their injured players also seem to get injured really quickly. I'm concerned. I mean, I don't know what their plan is with Garoppolo. I don't know what their long or short-term strategy is. If his ankle is really a problem, they need to rest him. They should have been resting him previously. But now they are sitting in a very vulnerable position in the NFC West at 4-4. They have the Packers and the Saints over the next 2 weeks before their bye. If they lose those games, they're probably out of the playoff race. So I think even given that Garoppolo's not 100%, even given that they are blaming the ankle, I don't think they have much of a choice but to go back to Garoppolo for Thursday night on a short week against the Packers.
Well, Bill Barnwell, as our democracy hangs in the balance, fluttering like a Ben DiNucci sidearm pass, thank you for joining us on ESPN Daily.
Pablo, as Jory Epstein of USA Today noted, Ben DiNucci said after the Cowboys game today, quote unquote, "This NFL thing, it's hard."
Coming up, pro sports this year have been severely disrupted in both schedule and TV viewership, but the legendary Julie Foudy tells me about one area that has grown more valuable amid all of the chaos.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. You may have heard by now that fewer people are watching sports in 2020 on account of all sorts of possible reasons. But it turns out that there is a category of sport that is very conspicuously bucking that trend. ESPN's numbers show that the 2020 WNBA Finals got 15% more viewers than last year. The Seattle Storm's championship ceiling Game 3 was up 27% over the league's final game last year. And now, in women's soccer, the outlet Sports Pro Media says the NWSL saw a 500%, yes, 500% increase in its domestic television audience over last year. So I asked U.S. soccer legend and laughter-permitted podcast host Julie Foudy to weigh in. So, Julie, what do you think got so many more people watching the National Women's Soccer League this year?
Pablo, it's about time we all realize women's soccer chicks are rad, right? Let's just go there. It's obvious. I think a couple reasons. I think that you had a change, obviously, from cable to network. And so now they've shifted over, of course, to CBS. And CBS put a few of those on its network, which makes a huge deal. I think also that the fact that NWSL was first out of the gate in the middle of the pandemic. And so you had a lot of eyeballs and a lot of attention on that. I think there were more sponsors, which means more activation. I think the announcement of Angel City, I'm a little bit biased here as one of its co-owners and the LA team had a big boost as well. So I think there was a lot of good things that happened in the middle of a pandemic among, you know, all times that contributed to that.
Yeah, I want to talk about the sponsorship stuff a little bit because we've seen them get more sponsors, as you mentioned, corporate sponsors, but there's still a sponsorship gap compared to the men. So does the increase in viewers get sponsors to sign on automatically, or how does that whole thing work?
I think it clearly helps, right? But I think the biggest challenge on the women's side for so many years, and this is not just professionally with the league, but with the national team as well and World Cups, is getting those sponsors to activate. And what you're seeing, what's really interesting, is they're not just putting a name to it, right? They're actually getting behind it. I mean, look at Budweiser.
In 2019, the men's MLS had 8 times more sponsors than the women's NWSL. And as one of the only three NWSL sponsors, Budweiser wanted to change that. So in order to close the pay gap, we had to address the sponsorship gap. Budweiser introduces the future official sponsors of the NWSL.
I mean, there was this loyalty and affinity to Budweiser from the NWSL soccer fan base that I've never seen in a sponsorship activation before. I think that is also something that we've seen evolve over the years with women's sports. That's so encouraging to see is that, you know, you want in before a World Cup, you walk into a supermarket and you've got secret deodorant and all the deodorants are different players from the women's national team, things like that, that you just didn't see Coca-Cola cans with their names on them. So it's very different in a sense that way. And I think those numbers definitely help.
So those numbers, how does the bump in viewership for the league relate to issues of equality and pay? I mean, we've talked about that issue with the U.S. women's national team, of course, for years and years now. What's the connectivity between these issues?
At the national team level, obviously, the women's team is fighting for equal pay, but it's a different venture altogether at the league level because you have some of those obvious barriers to equal pay that are there for a reason, right? Now, as an owner, I'm, you know, all of a sudden you go, okay, wait, but there is a reason they're there. I do think, though, one of the things that Angel City is going to push the envelope on as a new team is just how do we start creating then, if it can't be through salary cap, how do we start creating alternative sources of income revenue for these players? For example, could we give them a percentage of revenue? Could we give them a percentage of merchandise? And getting creative in a way that, you know, we've seen other leagues do, but we haven't seen as much in soccer.
It's funny to hear an owner of a team talk about, well, how can we be collectively more generous towards labor? I mean,
the power of having players as owners, right? I mean, the first thing, literally, Pablo, we had a Zoom call the other day with our ownership group, and it's fantastic, first of all, because it's like, oh, hey, Natalie Portman. Oh, hey, Eva Longoria. Oh, hey, America Ferreira. You know, it's like this crazy collective. Right. Group of awesome women. Abby's on, of course, because she's part, Abby Wambach is part of our group. Mia, we have the whole player side. So Abby has this first comment when we finish and wrap, when we're finishing the call and it gets opened up to questions. And she says, hey, can we think about how we create some type of retirement fund for these players? Because that's the thing that we all struggle with as female athletes when we retire.
Yeah. So you're a clear, literal stockholder. You're invested in women's sports in the most legal sense, but also obviously as a passion, given who you are. So what is a jump like this in the numbers, Julie? What does it say about the future of women's pro sports? And do you see these numbers sticking as time goes on?
You know what they say, bet on women, right? We've heard it from the WNBA. We've heard it from a lot of sports entities. And I think it's the right thing. With U.S. soccer back in the day, we used to say, if you just spent a little, if you just watered that garden a little, your return on investment, your ROI would be huge. So I think what these numbers are showing in the middle of a pandemic, when everyone thought that women's sports would come tumbling down in this, that there's resiliency to that. And not just resiliency, right? But there's a bright spot that we should all be paying attention to.
Julie Foudy, I am very jealous of your Zoom calls, and I thank you for joining ESPN Daily.
All right, Pablo, thank you.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.